What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Squanch, Wisecrack's Rick and Morty podcast. My name is Jared, and I'm joined here with, unfortunately, only one of the Squanchers today, but we got a great Squancher with us. We got Alec. What's up, Alec?
Hey. Was that Jerry enough?
That was pretty Jerry. Ryan, unfortunately, booked a flight back to Memphis, and he totally spaced this morning, so he won't be with us to discuss the season finale of season 4 of Rick and Morty. That's season 4, episode 10, Rick Turn of the Jerry. As always, we're going to go around and get some first impressions. What was it like watching this episode? Alec, what'd you think of the episode?
I really, really liked it. I think an A+. I think...
Hell yeah.
I don't know how many A+'s I've given, but I was laughing my ass off all the time, which I don't often laugh out loud like that, but was just also engrossed in the Star Wars bullshit that was happening. Really like just the premise with the Beth versus Beth and the whole clone thing. I thought it was like really captivating and interesting. What about you?
Well, I certainly didn't expect what they turned out to do. I mean, because I'm always thinking that whenever they tease some sort of serialized element, that they're probably either going to never come back to it like they do with Evil Morty, or, well, I mean, I guess they kind of tease Evil Morty every once in a while, but we never really get anything fully fleshed out about him. And I always assume that a lot of these serialized elements are probably just these one note jokes. Like, I didn't think that Phoenix Person would ever come back, although maybe that's kind of a dumb thing to think, because Bird Person's such a good character. They need to get him back in there somehow, which I think is going to happen because it seems like Rick is going to rebuild him. But I didn't think they would ever address the Beth as a clone thing, because it's something that works so beautifully as something that's just ambiguous. And interestingly, we still are in that state where we don't know who's the clone. So it's still ambiguous. It was an interesting way to end the season. I thought it was funny. I thought it was a really well-made episode. I was completely wrong in my guess that they would end the season with some sort of like pseudo breakup between Rick and Morty, because there'd been some like bubbling tension between the two of them, but rather they kind of just continued with Beth's seeking approval of her father that we saw a little bit in the last episode, and brought back all these serialized elements and really gave the people what they wanted. And I thought it was pretty glorious.
Not that there was a Rick and Morty breakup, but there was a kind of fuck you, we don't care about you, as they storm off and don't watch his what are they called, the memory crystals?
Oh, well, that was the Beths.
Yeah, but the whole family is like, nobody cares, because he kind of invites everyone to watch it with him.
Well, see, it's that's the attitude that I thought the show was taking, is that nobody cares whether or not Beth is really a clone or the other one is the clone. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the attitude that I came away with at the end of that episode in season 3. And I assumed that the creators thought similarly, and I still think that they think that, but I guess we have now this new episode that reinforces that. But overall, I thought it was a great way to end the season, an explosive way to end the season, man. That fight scene between Phoenix Person and Rick was PP was fucking raw. Also, and I'll get to this after the recap, this episode has one of the most, I don't know if I mean, I'll call it obscure, but one of my favorite references it's ever made, but it's also one that, although I get the reference, I don't understand why they made it.
I think I know what you're talking about. Is it, I had to Google, I was like, that's gotta be from something.
Oh man, you Googled it. If it came up immediately, I'm surprised, but let's do that after the recap. So we open the episode with a space adventuring Beth fighting the new Galactic Federation, suggesting that she is the real Beth C-137, and that back in season 3, she actually did take Rick up on his offer to clone her and liberate her to do what she wants. Or so she thinks. Thinking an explosive device resides in her neck, she returns to C-137 to kill Rick. Summer and Morty fight over Rick's invisibility belt while the new Galactic Federation, led by Tammy, breaks into Dr. Wong's office to pursue adventurer Beth. The two Beths meet, get captured by the Federation, and Rick kills Tammy as a Death Star ripoff starts to destroy Earth. On board the Death Star ripoff, Rick fights Phoenix Person while the Beths escape together. Due to the Death Star's sponsored deal with Wrangler, Summer is able to destroy the laser by putting Morty's Wrangler jeans in the way of the laser. Using the invisibility belt, Jerry weakened at Bernie's Tammy, giving Beth enough time to turn Bird Person off and save Rick. Back at the Smith house, Rick offers the Beths knowledge of who the real clone actually is, but both of them have more important things to worry about. Rick looks at the memory and reveals that Beth left it up to Rick, and Rick left it up to chance. In the post-credits, Jerry tries to throw away the invisibility belt, but it turns the garbage truck invisible, which starts a whole new franchise of Invisible Garbage Truck Jerry until he runs out of gas. End of episode.
It's a new franchise.
It's a new franchise. I'd watch it.
Another Dan Harmon song, too.
You know, I have a theory about Dan Harmon being in a lot of these episodes, but I'll get to that after. Speaking of sponsored deals, this episode is brought to you by a really cool card game called Forks in the Timeline. I don't know if you guys can see it, but I'm holding it up right now if you guys are watching the live stream or watching this on Wisecast. Forks in the Timeline is a really cool Rick and Morty-esque card game because it's a party game that, and the thing I like about it is it's all about creativity. A lot of party games are about creativity, but I think this one is in, I think this one is in particular. It's very simple. So there's three different kinds of cards. There's a question, a fork, and a bonus. And basically, like other party games, you have a judge who judges who gives the best answer. So you pick a question. So for example, I just picked a question. What question would you ask a fortune teller? And then you pick a fork. And the fork is like the fork in the timeline or various different timelines like you would have in a Rick and Morty-like scenario. And the fork is in a timeline where humans have only two fingers per hand. So then you would go around and ask all the people that you're playing with is what question would you ask a fortune teller in a timeline where humans have only two fingers per hand? And whoever gives the best answer as dictated by the judge wins 5 points. The person who gets the second best answer gets 2 points. And then you just play until you get X amount of points or until you want to stop playing. It's a pretty loose game. The bonus points can give you more points, can screw with your neighbor, give them less points, whatever. The thing I really like about this game is it's almost like writing exercise prompts because a lot of these questions and forks, when you combine them together, they really make you bend your mind to get those creative juices flowing and get some of those really cool answers. So it's Forks in the Timeline right now. The first 100 Wisecrack fans to use the link in the show notes or go to forksinthetimeline.com/store and use the promo code Wisecrack. You can get 10% off the game with the promo code Wisecrack at forksinthetimeline.com/store. And now back to the show. All right. So should we talk about the Star Wars shenanigans first, or do you want to talk, or do you want to guess about the obscure reference?
Let's get to the obscure reference. Is it
okay?
I expected to die in Venice.
Yes.
By a dwarf in a raincoat.
Yeah.
I just typed in Google dwarf raincoat Venice and a movie popped up and I barely read about it. So you can still enlighten me. The movie is called,
it's called Don't Look Now.
Yes.
And it's a real shame that Ryan isn't here because Nicholas Roeg, who directed this movie, is one of both Ryan and I's favorite directors.
Oh, wow.
And the ending of this movie is pretty notorious for being just freaky.
It's a horror movie, right? Like, what's the setup?
The setup is, it's been a while since I've seen it, but basically Kiefer Sutherland and his wife witness a horrific accident when their daughter dies and they go to Venice to try to patch up their relationship. I think this is what it's about. But then creepy things start happening in Venice. And really, spoilers, the ending, there's some pretty surreal things. The one thing I do remember about the movie very vividly is that it's got one of the best sex scenes ever. And when I say one of the best sex scenes ever, I don't mean it's necessarily erotic. Yeah, it's not necessarily erotic or steamy, but it's just very raw and feels very real. So I definitely recommend the movie Don't Look Now. You're not going to glean any extra knowledge about this episode from watching the movie, but I can just say that it's a really eerie movie, a really effective movie, and it's old school Donald Sutherland, and I really recommend it. As far as why Rick said that, I don't know, man. It really just seemed like a pretty random reference, because even in the movie, everyone watches that movie. And as soon as that happens in the end, everyone's just like, what the fuck? What was that? And so
I have to imagine it's getting murdered by a dwarf in a raincoat.
It's getting murdered by a dwarf like figure. Cause even when you watch the movie, you're like, wait, what was that? It was definitely something short, but it definitely looks a little bit more deformed than just a regular little person. Like it's some sort of creature in a movie that had no supernatural elements up until that point. If you could even call it supernatural.
I want to watch this movie. Is this going to be our new network?
Probably not, just because network. I mean, I prefer Network. It's a better movie, but I can't really say I prefer Nicholas Rogue over Sidney Lumet, or Lumet, whatever his name is. But it's pretty awesome. So I definitely recommend everyone check it out. But
do you think, I'm curious, you know how sometimes, God, I can't, there's like a name, like famous people will mention a product, and sometimes there'll be, I'm just going to call it like the Jared effect, where like Jared, you know, shouts out that he loves Taco Bell and everyone goes, not that. I mean, Szechuan sauce is the perfect example, but do you think, you know, last episode there was a reference to The Prestige. Now there's an episode, a reference to this. Do you think like you could see like huge spikes in people watching these movies, or do you think most people are like, whatever?
I bet you there's a spike. I don't know if it's a huge spike, but if that was their intention, then I say bravo. Thank you guys for, you know, spreading the word about this awesome movie.
It would also be amazing if they could just shout out random movies and we could be like ahead of it and then make episodes about like the philosophy of The Prestige.
Well, I don't think that many people are going to watch Don't Look Now because of that one reference that goes by so fast. All right. Well, what's the Star Wars shenanigans you wanted to talk about?
Oh, well, it's not that. I just said I liked it.
Just the general like Death Star shit.
Yeah, no. I don't think it was shenanigans. I mean, the joke in the show is now I have to go do the Star Wars bullshit, which has been a joke that they've been making for a while now. And I was enthralled. Like, I mean, it's kind of like a cheap setup. Oh, they're going to destroy the planet, but they're self-aware about it. And it's not, doesn't really take it away from me. And also what's kind of amazing is that at the beginning in the advertisement for, I think it's the NX5 planet destroyer brought by Wranglers, they're like, and there's no stupid workarounds. Like we finally fixed all that. And then the dumb workaround is their advertising deal with the Wrangler jeans.
Yeah. The sponsored content. That's yeah. I quite like that. I mean, just because, you know, even a giant planet destroyer can't, you know, speak out against their sponsor.
Yeah.
Or else the whole thing just goes to shit.
Yeah.
What did you think about this episode? And actually probably a lot of the episodes this season, they make a lot of jokes about arcs.
I liked it. And I thought
I usually am critical of that, but I actually quite liked it this time because this episode, there's a lot going on. There was a lot to pack in. I'm surprised they even did the invisibility belt subplot with Morty and Summer because it's just over so quickly. And they make a joke about that. They say, we work together. That's our arc. Might not be Citizen Kane, but why mess with what's going on here? Because they're almost making fun of the fact that like, okay, they hate each other. They're at each other's throats trying to get this invisibility belt. They screw each other over and then bam, this big nasty machine comes and now all of a sudden they're working together. It's not the most fleshed out arc, but that's kind of the point because there's so much going on in this episode. And I think there's a fine line between it being laziness on the part of the writers and just being like, well, we can only work in a little bit here, a little bit of an arc here. So we might as well just slot it in, make fun of ourselves for trying to slam too much into one episode and move on.
I don't know. I also liked it. And I think, and we've talked about this a little bit, but I think the difference is, to me, there's a version of meta self-awareness where the only thing happening is the meta-ness. And that's why I kind of didn't like the Story Train episode in that like every little thing was being deconstructed and it was the motivation in itself. And I think this is just like, even without those jokes, I think the episode works. I think even from a writing standpoint, like, it's not like they made a bad choice and then are saying, oh, it's okay, we made this bad choice because XYZ writerly reasons. You know, when you're I don't think it's a fault that they tried to pack a lot in, but I think they have to be economical about some things. And they're right that like the main arc happening is whatever's happening between the Beths and Rick. And,
yeah,
you know, you have to, you can't just have Summer Morty and their B plot be completely nonsensical, completely meaningless. Like you have to add like a small amount of stakes and a small arc, and it's just an itty bitty one, and that's okay. And they're going to make a joke about that. And then they're going to make a joke later that Jerry has the best arc because it's so funny, because again, it's a completely,
but even that it's like barely an arc.
I know, but it's still the best arc because he ends up weekend at Bernie's-ing Tammy's dead body, saves the day, and it's so stupid and it's amazing and it's great. And then they're going to make a joke about how it's quote unquote the best arc, when again, the actual arc that they're going for, that the writers are actually interested in, is between clone Beth, whichever one that might be, and Rick.
Yeah. Well, I mean, specifically to go on more about Jerry's arc, it's that, and I didn't get this the first time I watched it because there was just so much going on, but it's Jerry's therapy puppet. You know how he
that's a great arc.
Yeah, so it goes from Jerry puppeteering a sock puppet with eyes in Dr. Wong's office to him puppeteering Tammy as the best arc of the episode.
It's Chekhov's puppet. I'm just gonna call everything Chekhov's blank. If you see a puppet early in act one, in act three someone's gonna be puppeteering a dead body. It's just how storytelling works.
Yeah, definitely. And then there was that one joke about Tammy, that she died the way she lived, over serialized. And would you say this is the most serialized episode of the season? It's got to be.
I think so. And this also goes back to what I was saying last week, in that I think it's pretty standard. I know we don't watch a lot of episodic TV these days, but even back in the day, episodic shows, something big would happen in the finale that had a serialized component, or the mid-season finale. And I'm okay with that. I think if there's like movement, maybe like three times a season, and most of the other stuff is kind of episodic, I like that. I still think I like the serialization the best, but I also think that they got, what is it, 40 more episodes to make now?
A lot. No, I think more than that, because they got an order for like 70 and they only made 10. So they have like 60 more. Gotcha. Yeah. You know, one thing I am kind of liking that I didn't expect to like is that Ricky's been getting his ass kicked lately.
I do like that. I like that he almost dies. He comes to terms with it.
Yeah.
I think it's good because, you know, you're going to get bored if everything is, you know, so easy for him. I like that. Another thing I really like, the show is so good with the small touches. In any show, I like the little small moments. And so when Jerry is peeing it with the invisibility thing, it gets on his feet and you see the small outline of his foot, and he just makes a comment about the floor being uneven. Such a great thing.
Yeah.
But also an even smaller little thing is that when it's revealed that Jerry is puppeteering Tammy's dead body, he's controlling her head by putting her hair in his mouth.
In his mouth.
Such a... Yeah. Little touches like that really, really go a long way.
Yeah, they definitely do. Yeah. Anything else about this episode that spoke to you? Or do you want to talk a little bit more about the Beths?
I think we should talk about that last. Let me just kind of scroll through. I like Morty's belt, Tiny Big Man Jr. good.
Or Beth, like, oh, Morty, look at you with your little nuts. Come on in here. Give me a hug.
Yeah. I like when Rick gets hit in the balls, he says, "Hey, Grayson, that's going to hurt in like 10 seconds.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Well, maybe not all of us, but most of us.
I've half been of there. Us.
When, I don't know if you noticed this, when Rick and Beth fight, they throw Pokeballs.
Yes, and they each have a Pokemon come out. Don't tell me that's an actual Pokemon, because I know you would know.
No, not that I saw. But Beth has the classic red Pokeball, but Rick has a blue Great Ball. His Pokeball is a little bit better. Has a higher catch rate. Talk about the two Beths. I like that. I guess this is about them. There's like a Frankenstein complex, but it took me a while. Like, I think Dan Harmon loves Frankenstein complexes, but in this case, it's two Beths, both of which don't know if they're actually a quote unquote creation of their maker. I mean, I guess they literally are because they're his daughter, but not knowing whether they're the clone and then trying to kill him.
Wait, does at any point in the episode, does Beth, the one that stayed with Jerry, does she try to kill Rick?
They're in the prison together and they both agree that they're going to go kill Rick.
But then they go and save him.
They save.
What changes?
They save him, but it's, I mean, they're both very mad at him and contemplate killing him.
See, I feel like we're missing a beat. What? There's got to be something that happens. They're too much a perfectionist for this.
They're killing all the bugs. Let me just look at my notes. Oh, yeah, I don't know. I think it's that bird person almost kills all of them, and then they turn, sorry, Phoenix person. PP. They turn PP off, but yeah, they contemplate killing him. The quote unquote clone one multiple times. The regular Beth at least agrees to go kill him. So I don't know.
Do you think that we're going to have both Beths as characters from now on?
I hope so. I think when I haven't liked the season before, it's because of the lack of the family and Beth and Summer and Jerry. And I think this version of Beth is great. I also think the sort of rebel version of her is great. It might get weird. Like, you know, it's always weird when sitcoms add in extra characters and you're like, oh, what the fuck? But I think I'm on board for now. And then I'll probably regret saying this later.
No, I don't think it's going to be a regular thing. I mean, if anything, it'll be like Phoenix Person or Bird Person. It just maybe once or twice a season.
Yeah,
I want Adventurer Beth to meet up with C-137 Jerry or, you know, Cronenberg Jerry. Yeah,
they would smash so hard.
Yeah, they would get along for sure. Yeah. What else?
I'm okay with them not revealing which one is which, because I think in Rick and Morty fashion, it actually doesn't matter in the spirit of there are infinite Earths and infinite versions of yourselves. And with that knowledge, and, you know, Beth knows this and Morty knows this and Rick knows this. Maybe Jerry knows it. It truly doesn't matter. And I think not that they're fucking with the audience, but, like, you know, the audience really wants to know, but we really want to know a thing that fundamentally doesn't matter in the most Rick and Morty way possible. And I kind of like that.
Well, ultimately, I think it doesn't matter also because when Beth decided that she might want to clone herself, it was because she was at this crossroads about who she is. Am I a family woman or am I my father's daughter who, you know, goes and starts slave rebellions and stuff like that? And I think the most powerful thing about the ending is that they both say that we don't care about your memory thing because we've got better stuff to do. And then the Beth that we're familiar with says, I've got to take care of my family. And the other one says, I've got adventuring to do or something like that.
The adventurer one even says we have to take care of a family and fight the new Federation.
The new Federation. Right. Right.
And so I think it's kind of both, and it's, I don't know if they're going to split the duty on traditional lines with, like, old, we'll call her Jerry Beth, taking care of the kids.
Oh, so that's one way to think about it. The way I was thinking about it is that they're just comfortable in their identities.
Yeah, I think so. And what I really like about it is that I think, I mean, in real life, people are at these crossroads and, you know, trying to define who they are. And I think the episode is kind of, not to say it doesn't matter, but both Beths are not necessarily, it's not like one Beth wins. Like, there's not a good or bad choice, which I really like. And both Beths are sort of haunted by what they are or are not doing. You know, they show Adventurer Beth at least aware of the fact that a clone Beth is back home. Obviously, like, even though she's doing exactly what Rick would be proud of, she clearly has some, like, daddy issues still. And I also think it's interesting that they kind of come to respect each other, because it's kind of saying, it's not, oh, I'm jealous of that other Beth. Like, why didn't I go become out and become an adventurer? Or, oh, why didn't I stay home with my family and, you know, be a good mother and all that? I don't know. I think it's smart to kind of affirm both of them.
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, definitely the thing that you don't want to do is, there's that part where what's the kind of pasta that Jerry likes?
Oh, dinosaur pasta. I think I know exactly. Yeah, dinosaur. It does taste better. I don't know why. The shape, it's like the surface area with the it's usually mac and cheese, right?
I don't know. I'm unfamiliar with dinosaur pasta.
Well, Jared, we gotta have you on a bonus episode. No, I'm kidding.
Anyway, the point I was trying to make is that it's good that Beth sees the alternative and is still able to defend the choice that she made to stay with Jerry, because, you know, we always see her giving Jerry so much shit. And I also like how this, in a serialized way, does carry over to, because I wonder if she would still feel this strongly if Jerry hadn't saved her in the last episode, like we talked about mm-hmm. in the last episode of the podcast.
Jerry keeps saving people.
He keeps saving people.
Exactly in a badass way like Cronenberg Jerry, but in his own Jerry way. And that's why Jerry's the best character.
Yeah, he saved Rick's life, and you're not going to see Rick say thank you.
God damn it. I had a question. So Beth, I forget which one, goes to punch Rick, but not really, and he flinches. Is that a callback? Does Rick do that to Jerry, or like at another season finale?
At which point is this?
So right at the end where he's trying to get them to watch the memory crystals.
He flinches.
And I swear to God, someone did that to Jerry. And it was like, haha, look at Jerry. He's so pathetic. And now Rick is the pathetic one.
That also rings a bell. I think you're right, but I can't exactly cite when exactly that happens.
Fair enough. But I do like that serialization, but I also wonder if, you know, Dan Harmon, when he talks about sitcoms, it's like everything has to happen, but functionally nothing can change. And I wonder if it's like, do you think some of the arcs are kind of just for show, in a sense? Like, are the characters now in season, at the end of season four, much different than they were in season one? Maybe.
I think it's going to just be very slow. Like, I don't think we're ever going to see Beth not want to seek her father's approval. I don't think we're ever going to see Jerry become the Cronenberg Jerry. I don't think we're ever going to see Morty stop being a horny little teenager. I think that, yeah, for most part, it is a little bit of lip service, but I mean, there are these baby steps that will be taken. But as far as being, you know, Jerry, for all of the good things that he's done, especially these past two episodes, he'll continue to be the butt of a joke for being unemployed and useless.
Yeah,
I don't think that's going to stop.
The commenters came through. There's a couple flinching moments. Apparently Jerry does it to Rick in the Whirly Dirly conspiracy. Rick and Summer also do this to the devil. Another commenter said,
oh yeah.
Jerry made Rick flinch when Rick was under the influence of the synaptic dampener. Is that in the Whirly Dirly conspiracy?
Synaptic dampener.
It makes him dumb. It's vaguely coming back to me. But anyway, thank you all of the people in the live stream for being better Rick and Morty fans than we are. No, I'm
kidding. Yes. I mean, thank you.
So there's that. Rick coming to real, yeah, on this sort of serialization, Rick coming to realization that he's a terrible father. I think that's probably lip service, kind of like him caring about Morty. Like, does he, doesn't he? I think it's kind of going to be in that perpetual ambiguity, I guess.
This is not the last time that we're going to end an episode with Rick looking sad.
Yeah.
There's just no, yeah. I mean, that's not going to stop. Although, I mean, it would be interesting to, because if Rick did decide that my main MO is to be a better father at the beginning of season five, I would love to see how he tries that, because I'm sure all his efforts would be very misguided.
Yeah, that I think, just not forever, but just as a season where he uses his technology to try to make his kids happy and take them to Wendy's or something, but they all get mad for a variety of other reasons. That could be maybe at least a couple episodes. I would like that. I think that's it. I do want to give a shout out. I forgot about this gem of a moment where there's the holdup. Jerry gets the gun and Rick says, everybody drop your guns except for fucking classic. And Jerry drops the gun.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's the only one, in fact.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have anything else? Should we get into the mailbag?
No, let's go ahead and go into some voicemails first. Oh, so yeah. You guys can hit us up at, actually, we probably won't be back until season five, or maybe if we score a good interview or something. But just in case we decide to do maybe a mailbag episode or something happens Rick and Morty related before season five comes out, you can hit us up at 213-534-8807 or 21ElfHut07. So first thing I got to mention is that we got a voicemail from Jeff further confirming Cannibal the Musical references. But unfortunately, and he put in the work and actually had some clips that he put together from Cannibal the Musical and this most recent episode, not the one that we're covering today, but the previous one. But unfortunately, we can't really hear the clips that he put together, so we're going to skip that one. But thank you, Jeff, for putting in the work and continuing to try and convince us that they're hardcore Cannibal the Musical fans. But anyway, we're going to start off with a voicemail from Jason.
Hey, Squanchers, this is Jason calling in about the most recent episode of Rick and Morty, The Childrick of Mort. You guys were talking about the Deus Ex Machina moment with the spaceship flying into the god that was about to kill Rick. And just one thing funny that I just realized is Deus Ex Machina literally translates to God in the machine. And in that moment, the spaceship flies into a god, so it's a machine in God. So I don't know if this was an intentional kind of play on words that the writers were going for, or if it's just a happy coincidence. In any case, I think it kind of results in something really funny that twists the Deus Ex Machina trope, and I enjoyed that. Love the show. Keep it up. Thanks.
That's an awesome voicemail.
I think it's a coincidence.
Really? I think it's, I don't know. There have been some Deus Ex Machina writers jokes in a couple of movies. My favorite one is in Toy Story 3. Spoilers, by the way. But in Toy Story 3, toward the end, when it's like the most soul-crushing moment in animated history, where you think all the toys are going to die, and then the claw descends from the sky and brings them out. So it's like literally a Deus Ex Machina in terms of the story mechanics, but it's also Deus Ex Machina in that literally there is a machine descending from the sky to bring our characters out. So, I mean, I think it could have possibly been intentional, because I think writers are usually pretty aware when they're employing a Deus Ex Machina, and if they have a literal god and a literal machine, I don't know. I think it's possible.
But I think it's God from the machine, but the god is not the Deus Ex Machina. It's the spaceship. And when you're doing sci-fi, any Deus Ex Machina, there's like what, like an 80% chance it's going to be like a laser gun or a ship, or you know, like you're just, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a good question. I'm reading about it on Wikipedia right now. I was like, wait, the Greeks didn't have machines, but they would lower actors on like cranes and stuff like that.
Pulleys and shit.
Yeah, that was the machines they were talking about. But yeah.
Cool. All right, we're going to go with Elliot.
Hey, Squanchers, this is Elliot, also known apparently now as Opera Guy. Enjoying the show. I wanted to hop in the prediction market here for season finale, and I am making this call on Wednesday, so if I'm right, and please send money. So this episode reminded me a great deal of ABC is the Best from season 3, in that you have a slew of really interesting, complicated, twisting philosophical content. You know, this evangelism about camping versus this extreme materialistic nihilism personified in this duel of the gods, you know, between Kid Rock, Zeus, and Rick. But when you boil all that stuff away, what you're left with is a very simple character story about Beth and her father, which I think seems to be where the show keeps going back thematically, or at least in terms of story continuity most often. And so my prediction is that we're going to revisit the topic of Beth and her status as a clone or a real person. I don't know if you guys caught it, but there was a moment early on in the episode where Rick said, "And you're definitely my daughter," or something to that effect. And Beth gave a little squeeze, just sort of reminding us that it's probably on her mind still as to whether she's real or not, even though she made a big deal about not caring in the season 3 season finale. Anyway, that's my idea, and we'll see who's right. Looking forward to it, and the podcast follow. Thanks, guys.
This guy's right. He's right.
Yeah, I had to play it because he was right and I was wrong, and I thought his accuracy was pretty baller.
Does he have any stock tips? I'm kidding.
Yeah, for real. All right, we're going to go with one from Zara.
Hi, Wisecrack. This is Zara calling from ASU, and I just wanted to kind of share a working theory that I have. I've been reading a lot about feminism, And Jerry's character is very interesting to me because we consistently see him attempting to do super masculine things for the family, putting up Christmas lights, trying to learn how to play golf, or camping. And we also see the family consistently shutting him down in those, in his attempts and in his efforts. And he inevitably fails. However, when we see him with other beings, or like with the Plutonians, or with the other world of Jerry's, and even in that the camping episode where he's, you know, gathers all the unproductives and becomes their leader, he is successful. His masculine traits do come out, and he does rise up to be a good, or to be a leader. Whether it's a leader of good causes or not is up to the viewer, and I'm pretty sure the writers are trying to make a commentary about masculinity and femininity with Jerry's character. So I don't think that his reoccurring plot line of being incompetent is getting old. I think that it's stringing along this idea of Jerry attempting to be the common idea of masculine. It just doesn't work. Thank you so much. I love the podcast. I drive 4 hours for work, and your guys' podcast saved my life. Thank you so much. Have a good day, everyone.
I'm so sorry about your awful commute, and thank you for that voicemail.
Thank you for the voicemail. That is rough, but I would totally agree. And especially in these last two episodes, we're seeing, a decidedly non-traditionally masculine Jerry save the day two times in a row.
Yeah, I think this has happened a lot in prior seasons too. I think the basic idea that there is like this kind of notion of masculinity that like a man puts up Christmas lights and all these things that I think Zara said. But a lot of that stuff, or I guess what I'm saying is that, like, I guess the stereotypical version of masculinity and that, like, you've got big muscles and you beat people up and protect your family is mostly, just completely obsolete in modern society. Like, to succeed in modern society, you have to do all these things, like, show up at a desk job for 8 hours a day and pay bills and, like, not go beat up people to protect your family. And so I think in modern society, people try to funnel it by... obviously, you know, people work out for lots of reasons, including being healthy, but we all know the dude bro who's like, I'm such a man, I take steroids. So there's like that kind of shit, and people try to sort of reclaim that masculinity by putting up Christmas lights and creating these narratives around like what their macho-ness revolves around. And Jerry just, it's interesting that Jerry fails at, I think, these sort of like outlets for masculinity in modern society, but like he does truly succeed, as she said, like, when he's camping or in the Cronenberg world or all those things. I think it's really interesting. I don't think there's like a simple answer, because I think the writers are both like making fun of like these notions of like, you know, what a man is by putting up Christmas lights, but also kind of commenting on how modern society ruins us all.
Yeah, I can see that. All right, let's go into the mailbag.
Yep.
You can send us an email at squanch@wisecrack.co. What have we got in there, Alec?
All right, here is an email from Armin. Hello, guys. From the previous episode of the podcast, Camping and Its Discontents, I missed you talking about the scene where one of the clay people is building the house and Jerry tears it down, supposedly out of his fear of becoming unnecessary again. What do you think? Also, when the clay people are traveling through tubes and bands, it reminded me of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where people are artificially conditioned and raised in social class from their infancy. Any thoughts on that? Best wishes, Armin from Hungary.
Well, as I think he's referring to the scene where someone builds a house and then he's like, no, you can't build any indoor things because once it becomes indoor, it's no longer camping. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this also speaks to Zara's voicemail on that. The only way he can be useful is to like affirm these dumb notions of like what his usefulness is, which is to make s'mores.
Right. Yeah. Make sure not to get the carbon on it.
And as far as the Aldous Huxley reference, I don't know if it was intentional, but I think that's definitely a good read. I haven't read Brave New World in a long time. I don't know if that's a sci-fi trope of like raising people from their born, but I don't know. I like that connection.
Yeah. I mean, certainly anytime there's like a high tech society that is, has some sort of central control that controls people's, controls people's everyday lives as well as, you know, to a very minute degree, I think there are going to be references to Brave New World.
Yeah. Here is an email from Jasmine. Jasmine says, after the episode, they had a commercial for Pocket Morty's introducing the new characters you can get. They introduced Space Beth as Clone Beth. Do you think that was an easy way to differentiate the two, or did they make a mistake and let us know who's who?
Wait a second. This is after last night's episode or the episode before? Yeah. Oh, I didn't see this.
I didn't see it either. I think marketing departments are often probably not talking to Justin Roiland, and I think it's just an easier way to differentiate them.
Yeah, I doubt that. I agree with that. It's probably something that the marketing department did for simplicity's sake.
Yeah.
So wait, which one did they say was the clone? They said that the adventurer. Space Beth. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't take anything that's like outside the actual show as canon.
I wouldn't even take stuff inside the show as canon.
That's a good point.
The last email we got is from Ranma, who says, here's a thought that popped into my head, and I want to know your thoughts on it. One of the biggest signs of a show's decline is the family scapegoat. I actually haven't heard of this, so I'm curious what you think, Jared. The writers don't know what to do for Meg. Sorry. Yeah, the writers and Family Guy don't know what to do for Meg, so they make her a universal punching bag. They run out of ideas for Bart in The Simpsons, so they just focus all the story about him on him being a failure whose family hates him. Every bad thing in the world is Timmy Turner's fault for existing, Squidward, etc. I don't know who Timmy Turner is, but
neither do I. I've never heard of this. So wait, she's saying for Rick and Morty it's Jerry or what?
Well, it gets interesting. Rick and Morty seems to be going the opposite with Jerry. He started out as the family scapegoat, and like with many of them, this makes him likable to the audience, as many fans point out a lot. He's right. As the show goes on, he's given a more sympathetic portrayal. He's still Jerry, but far less of a straw loser. We see that he's actually fairly competent, if massively insecure. We see more of the family's hypocritical and holier-than-thou treatment of him. Morty yells at him for making an app, but then turns around and starts an interdimensional snake war. Do you think this is intentional or just a result of better writing? I like that.
I don't think that they're running out of ideas. I think that shows like Family Guy and The Simpsons, first of all, they've been on for a lot longer, but they also don't have the sci-fi element that allows them to really do anything. And as we saw with, you know, you'll never see in an episode of The Simpsons, Bart get, well, gosh, I was just going to say, like, you're never going to see Bart get godlike powers, like in the last episode of Rick and Morty. But then again, The Simpsons has been on for longer than I've been alive, so I'm sure I'm probably wrong because they've probably done everything. But I think the way that they've been handling Jerry has actually been really smart and really dynamic. And I don't think it's certainly not getting old yet. And I think they've got plenty of ideas and plenty of ways to play with, because we've talked about even in this episode how Jerry is able to surprise us by overcoming the biggest obstacles in the episode, but not by being this traditionally masculine person. With the with the invisibility belt and all these other sci-fi opportunities, there's going to be a lot of really fresh ways to do that. So I don't think it runs the risk of getting that stale.
Well, I think Ranma was saying that the show is doing the opposite of Meg, right? Meg starts off as Meg and Family Guy, and then every episode becomes about how the whole family hates her. In Rick and Morty, it starts there. And it still happens, but I think the joke is more, I think probably one of the strengths about Dan Harmon specifically is that he really probably has a way better understanding of this in sitcoms than any of us do. And you know, sometimes he'll follow certain tropes and do that knowingly, but sometimes he'll just tweak that trope a little bit, and go the other way. And if Jerry is working in a way that maybe Meg ends up not working, it's probably because Dan Harmon's really smart about this stuff.
Yeah, Dan Harmon. And, you know, although we haven't really talked about Solar Opposites on this podcast, I've seen like half of it. All I can say, I don't really have, honestly, that many thoughts about the show, is that you can feel the absence of Dan Harmon.
Yeah, that's actually the last email. There was an email that I didn't pull to read because I didn't have time to confirm some of it. And I apologize to who wrote this, because otherwise I'd say your name. But we got an email saying that there's like a noticeable lack of Justin Roiland, and I was like, is that true? And then was asking if there.
Wait, you mean Dan Harmon?
No, in Rick and Morty, like Dan Harmon is showing up more. He's voicing more characters. And I rewatched this. I was like, I don't know if that's true. And then I rewatched this latest episode. I was like, oh, the Doctor is voiced by Dan Harmon. And also Dan Harmon has a song.
Oh, yeah. The reason why they do that, by the way, I think I teased that earlier in the episode, because they get paid double. Because they get, not only is Dan Harmon now in the Writers Guild and the Producers Guild, but now he's also in Screen Actors Guild. And so every time an episode of Rick and Morty plays and his voice is on there for X amount of seconds, his check just like basically triples.
That's amazing. Do you think, wait, do you think he gets royalties for the song?
Of course. If it plays on TV, then he does. Oh, do I think it's like, what is that? Probably. I mean, so I once had a conversation with somebody who works at Showtime. And so I was asking them about Twin Peaks, because Twin Peaks is my favorite show of all time. And they told me that David Lynch, who's like one of my idols, he said like, yeah, David Lynch basically wrote himself into the bulk of season 3 of Twin Peaks just because he wanted to get the director's check and like all the benefits from not only the Directors Guild and the Producers Guild, but also the Screen Actors Guild. And I was like, oh, okay. And I know somebody who's a location assistant on the show Modern Family, mm-hmm. and she put her son in one shot or like one line of Modern Family. She was able to get him, and that kid still gets checks like monthly that are not like a significant amount of money, but you know, like hundreds of dollars every couple months, you know, and that's pretty significant for just one shot.
You think about that versus the royalties of like Mike Burns published a book on Kierkegaard a while ago, and he probably gets like a check for like 33 cents every other month.
that's what it pays to be the bad boy of Danish philosophy.
Yeah. Sorry, this whole Dan, first of all, love this hustle that Dan Harmon is running. But it reminds me of the famous story is the original Star Trek has the theme song that's instrumental, but technically it has words to it. And I believe the words were written by Gene Roddenberry, and he never intended the words to be in there, but so he could get the royalty checks for writing the lyrics to the song that they use for the theme song, even though they don't play the lyrics.
And so he still gets
dead.
His estate still gets that check.
I don't know if he still does, but for a while he was collecting that theme song money.
Yeah, these people know what they're doing, especially when you're Dan Harmon, you're running the ship. You get to decide how many checks you get.
Yeah.
Pretty nice.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
All right. Anyway, guys. Oh, well, I guess last thing, Alec, overall thoughts on season 4.
I liked it. I thought it was overall like pretty good. As Ryan always says, like for compared to regular TV, it's amazing. For like Rick and Morty, pretty good. Like it's not my favorite season by any means. I really love this last episode, and I like the episode before that. But yeah, I hope that, to be honest, like I hope they just kind of keep trying new stuff in further seasons. And I know this season was kind of the back to basics as they teased at the end of season 3. I don't know. I hope they fuck around a lot more in future seasons.
So I think it's the opposite. I thought Back to Basics was the completely episodic ones, like the...
No, that's what I'm saying. Excuse me. The season is like the back to...
Oh. I thought you were talking about this last
season. No. The season 3 finale, Rick gives a speech to the family like, oh, I forget what it is, but we had talked about it on Squanch earlier about...
Right. And then in season 4, episode 1, he says it's going to be a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Yeah. And this most recent episode was definitely a little bit of that.
Yeah.
I agree. I think it was a good season. I think if they're able to maintain this level of quality throughout the rest of the 60 episodes they have, I think it's going to be an awesome show. It's going to be a really great ride.
Speaking of 60 episodes, I don't know if we talked about this, but we got an email. Someone was like, oh, the reason it's 70 episodes is because I forget the number. You need 90 episodes or 100 episodes to get syndication rights or the ability to syndicate and then collect royalty checks that way. So,
oh my God. And then with all those Dan Harmon songs, he's going to be getting so much money.
God. Yeah. Does he need it? I mean, I want him to be well compensated, but does he need it?
I don't know, but I...
I guess it's him or like some network executive. I'd rather him have it.
Yeah, he's putting in the work, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that does it for season 4 of Rick and Morty. We will be back, of course, with season 5. And if we land any good interviews or anything like that, we will be back before then. But I want to thank the squanchers. I want to thank Alec. Thank you for squanching with me this season.
It's disgusting, but thank you.
Yeah. And I want to also thank Ryan, even though he's not here. But until season 5, we'll squanch you later, guys.
Squanch you later.
Peace.